Thank you for tuning in to the Sun Also Rises radio show and podcast. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, and we'll begin today's episode back in the year 1610, when the Italian polymath Galileo Galilei took a telescope, which was technology that had only been invented a few months earlier, and he pointed it at Saturn. And here's what Galileo wrote in his journal that night about what he saw. To my very great amazement, Saturn was seen to me to be not a single star, but three together, which almost touch each other. So this was a big moment. By pointing this new technology toward the night sky, Galileo and other astronomers of that era were suddenly able to see far more of the universe's detail than mankind had been able to for millennia. But as shown by Galileo's error, mistaking Saturn's rings for a pair of moons, their window into the cosmos was still foggy. It was still obscure. The obscurity was caused by something that's vital for life on Earth, but a serious hindrance for stargazers, and that is Earth's atmosphere. The atmosphere accomplishes several crucial things for life on Earth. It provides oxygen-rich air to breathe. It gives protection from both solar radiation and from meteorites and other objects coming toward Earth. And it also retains heat to keep the planet from becoming a frozen wasteland. So clearly, without the haze of gases that is the atmosphere, life on Earth, as we know it anyway, wouldn't be possible. But the trouble for stargazers is that when light passes through the atmosphere, some wavelengths are entirely absorbed by it, and others are shifted and distorted. This is what makes stars have the appearance of twinkling. And it makes the view of the cosmos, for anyone looking up from Earth, blurry. In his book, The Universe in a Mirror, Robert Zimmerman writes, quote, "Trapped on the Earth within its unsteady and hazy atmosphere, astronomers were condemned to look at the heavens as though they had bad vision and were forbidden from using glasses." End quote. So that's why, even with a telescope, Galileo couldn't see clearly. That's why he thought the rings of Saturn were moons. And then, even as telescope technology greatly improved from Galileo's time on into the 1900s, what astronomers could see and photograph of the heavens remained fuzzy and revealed little detail. In the 1920s, some astronomers began to discuss just how beneficial it would be to place a telescope up in orbit, where it would float above the atmosphere and be able to capture clear images. But for many years, this was only a dream for the starry-eyed. Then in 1946, as rocket technology was taking off, the American astronomer Lyman Spitzer wrote an article detailing exactly how scientists could place a telescope up in orbit. And he said that such a telescope would uncover new phenomena not yet imagined and would revolutionize our view of the cosmos. Spitzer's article didn't make any real impact on other scientists of that era, but it did leave a crater-deep impact on his own mind. From 1946 on, he devoted himself almost entirely to turning this idea on paper into a giant Earth-orbiting telescope. He blasted through expanses of data. He puzzled out myriad technical problems, and he tried to convince others of the idea's merit. But that last part was particularly difficult. Spitzer later said, quote, "Most astronomers didn't take it seriously. They thought I was sort of wild-eyed or wide-eyed, one or the other." But however wild or wide they may have been, Lyman Spitzer kept his eyes focused on the goal. And one by one, other astronomers began to see his vision. And then, in 1966, at the height of the space race, Spitzer was given the green light by the National Academy of Sciences to turn his vision into a reality. This decision by the National Academy of Sciences was a major victory, but the project's greatest hurdles still lay ahead. The engineering challenge was enormous, and astronomy skeptics and political skeptics abounded. And because of that, funding was repeatedly delayed. A target launch in 1979 slipped by. Then another target launch in 1983 also hurtled past. That year, the project was renamed after Edwin Hubble, the man who had set the science world ablaze in the 1920s by proving that the universe is expanding in all directions. So from then on, it was known as the Hubble Space Telescope. And starting around then, work on it really shifted into high gear. Teams of technicians from Lockheed, Perkin-Elmer, the Wide Field Planetary Camera Team, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and the Space Telescope Science Institute all worked under the supervision of Marshall Space Flight Center. In 1986, technicians from these various crews were piecing their numerous different components together, and the launch by the end of the year seemed to be on target. Astronomers around the world were just, you know, over the moon with anticipation. That clear window into the heavens that had always been closed looked as if it were just about to be open. But on January 28th, NASA suffered one of the darkest and just most difficult tragedies in its history.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
The Space Shuttle Challenger disintegrated during launch, killing all seven of its crew. So all shuttles at that time were grounded, and Hubble was boxed up, put into storage in California. It wasn't until about 3 years later that Hubble was unpacked and shipped to the Kennedy Space Station in Florida. And then finally, on April 24th of 1990, nearly 45 years after Spitzer had made a case for a space telescope and had started laboring on it, Hubble was launched into space. That was 30 years ago this month. And the launch was successful. So this 43-foot-long telescope was released into low Earth orbit, just about 350 miles above Earth's surface and well above the atmosphere. So at last, after millennia of viewing the heavens through a haze, mankind was on the cusp of seeing it through a perfect prescription lens. That, at least, was what everyone was expecting. NASA spent weeks tweaking Hubble's systems before they tried to take any pictures, but when they finally did take a few, the photos looked as though they'd been shot through a thick London fog. Officials adjusted every variable they could from Earth, but to no avail. David Leckrone, who was part of the Hubble program at the time, talked about this catastrophe in an interview with Astronomy, and he said, quote, "Nothing we did made the image much better. The mood became very morose." They soon diagnosed the ailment. It was a spherical aberration in the telescope's main mirror. The mirror's curve had been ground to within about 10 nanometers of accuracy at all points. So that means it was allowed to have variations only about the equivalent of 1/10,000th the width of a human hair. And that incredible level of accuracy made Hubble's mirror by far the most precise of any in optics history. But the trouble was that before it was launched, the device on Earth that had tested the mirror had been assembled incorrectly. And that caused serious distortion that they didn't know about until Hubble was already up in orbit. It took a little while and quite a lot of funding to devise a solution. But in 1993, a team of astronauts flew up to Hubble, and they spent 10 days replacing its wide field and planetary camera with a new one that had been fitted with just a whole array of modified small mirrors that were specially made to offset the distortion of the main mirror. And just as a little side note here, the technology that was used to repair Hubble's optical problems ended up having some unexpected applications for the technology used for breast cancer detection. And so it led to a huge improvement in those methods, and it's said to have saved countless lives since then. But anyway, the repair of Hubble was successful, and so then, after millennia of viewing the heavens through kind of a foggy, distorting haze, humanity was finally able to actually view it through that perfect lens. And what it has shown us is absolutely staggering.
The Hubble telescope has sent back some of the most moving, stirring, exciting pictures you've ever seen in your life, or any men have ever seen, because there have never been any like it before on this planet.
That was Mr. Gerald Fleury speaking there during an episode of his show, The Key of David, which was first broadcast on January 18th of 2013. And he's exactly right about just how moving and how stirring the images from Hubble have been, and also about how much they've increased and clarified our understanding of the universe. Hubble gave us an amazingly clear view that we otherwise could not have had. The former astronaut, Michael Massimino, said, quote, "The reason we have the stars twinkle at night is because the light is being blurred by the atmosphere around the Earth. That's why the Hubble Space Telescope is so good, because it is above the atmosphere. So it's kind of like looking at the sun from the bottom of a swimming pool versus looking at the sun above the swimming pool." So it's clear that Hubble clarified our view to an incredible degree. And that clarity shined amazing light on the mysteries of dark matter and dark energy, which makes up about 70% of the universe. Hubble also allowed us to capture images of remote supernovas, which showed us that the universe's expansion is not slowing, like we long thought it was, but is actually accelerating. Hubble has also given us unprecedented insight into exoplanets, and it revealed the ubiquity of black holes, showing that almost all large galaxies center around one. It showed us so much beauty. The American science writer Michael Shermer said, "A Hubble photograph of the universe evokes far more awe for creation than light streaming through a stained glass window in a cathedral." And then Hubble also showed us something particularly momentous that we nearly missed. And that's because the telescope was typically used only to take a careful look at known objects.
You want to study a star? Okay, you know what star you're going to study. You point the telescope at that star.
That's Robert Williams in an interview conducted by Joss Fong. Dr. Williams was made the director of Hubble back in the mid-1990s, and not long after he was hired, he kind of upset a lot of people by deciding to point the telescope at nothing in particular.
What we were doing basically was just the opposite. We were trying to find a sort of an indiscriminate area of the sky where no observation had been made before.
The reason this was upsetting to so many people was because Hubble, at the time of its launch, was the most expensive scientific project in history. $2.1 billion. And then for 3 years, it didn't work because of that massive setback and embarrassment from the mirror problem. And then it had only just been repaired, and scientists and other people were eager to point it at all the exciting stars and planets and quasars that we knew about to get a better look at them. And they were skeptical about the value of pointing it at an indiscriminate area, an area that seemed to be, you know, just empty, dark, void. But Robert Williams persisted, and here he is again in an interview with Sophie Shevardnadze.
I thought it was sufficiently important that I was willing to take a risk and point Hubble at what I call an undistinguished spot in the sky. I thought it was worth a scientific risk, and fortunately I had a very good team of young scientists helping me.
So Williams and his team took this risk. They risked further alienating the American public, whose tax dollars had funded this multi-billion dollar project, and who had been so vexed by those initial mirror problems. But Williams put all that aside, and he pointed the telescope at a tiny, dark little spot. It was a spot of the sky that was about the size of a pinhead if you held the pin out at arm's length. And they made Hubble just stare at this spot with an intense and prolonged gaze for 10 full days. It started on December 18th of 1995, and it just stared at it until December 28th, and it collected four different wavelengths of light and ended up producing probably the most sensational and important discovery that Hubble has made. The image that this 10-day project produced is known as the Hubble Deep Field. And it showed us that even parts of the firmament that we thought were dark and empty are actually radiant with galaxies. Some of them are thought to be more than 12 billion light years away. So that means we're seeing them as they were 12 billion years ago, not very long after the universe is believed to have been created. So this allowed us to peer at the early eons of the cosmos, and it let astronomers pin down the universe's basic age. After the success of that first deep field, the Hubble crew repeated it with some other apparently unremarkable and apparently empty spots in the night sky. And the results were always the same. What we thought was empty, what we thought was dark, is actually full of radiance and all kinds of celestial bodies. These deep field discoveries greatly boosted the estimates of the total number of galaxies in the universe, and they allowed scientists to chronicle the history of star formation through the universe. In the 30 years since its launch, Hubble has taken hundreds of thousands of the most breathtaking photos ever captured. Stars being born, galaxies entering their adolescent years, supernovas dying, nebula of size incomprehensible, galaxies of hues uncategorizable, and celestial bodies so far away our brains can't begin to fathom the distance. In the Universe in a Mirror, Robert Zimmerman enumerates all of these, you know, various stunning discoveries, and then he says, quote, "Hubble and the men and women behind it opened a rare window into the universe, dazzling humanity with sights never before seen." In Mr. Fleury's Key of David episode that we mentioned a moment ago, he discusses how astounding all these discoveries were, but then he explains that there's an aspect of Hubble's discoveries that's even more important. And we can get a glimpse of this by going back to long before Robert Williams or Lyman Spitzer, long before even Galileo. We have to go back about 3,000 years ago. When King David looked up at the heavens, he saw them only with the naked eye. But he gaped breathlessly at God's creation, and he was particularly fascinated by mankind's place within it. In Psalm 8, verses 3 through 4, David said to God, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him?" Later in the psalm, David said, "The same God who created the radiant cosmos also made human beings to have dominion over his creation on earth." The Apostle Paul, about 1,000 years after David, quoted part of that same psalm and brought additional meaning to it. In Hebrews chapter 2, Paul makes clear that God will not give mankind control just over the earth, but that he'll actually put everything in subjection under him. The whole universe. God created it all for man. Everything Hubble has shown us, from the four moons it discovered around Pluto, right here in our own solar system, to the most unfathomably remote galaxy, it'll all be under mankind's control. That's a foundational message declared in numerous scriptures, and Hubble's images could be seen as the companion photos that you could print alongside those scriptures. Here's Mr. Fleury once again.
It's about your potential if you understand what the Bible is teaching. It's about your potential. Why all of that vast universe anyhow? Well, God wants us to know, why are we here? What God has for us to see with our eyes, ought to just set our imaginations on fire. It is that soul-stirring. It is that wonderful. That cosmos out there is there, if we understand it the way the Bible teaches it, so that we can get to know God. It's a major way that we get to know God and know about our own future. That's something we need to look into very carefully.
Mr. Fleury goes on in that very powerful episode to say that God had a hand in the Hubble telescope. The Creator helped to make this starry-eyed dream become a reality 30 years ago this month, so that all of us on Earth could have a clear look, a rare window opened up for us to see man's out-of-this-world future. So the Hubble is an incredible accomplishment with God's fingerprints all over it. And it's astounding, really, to meditate on the fact that Spitzer and Lecrone and the thousands of others who labored for decades to put Hubble into orbit weren't working alone, but they were guided on some level by a divine hand, eager to give people this vision. I think that understanding can help us to better appreciate the efforts of all those people that made this vision a reality and, you know, help to open up this rare window that we now have into the heavens. Mr. Joel Hilliker, who hosts the Trumpet Hour show here on KPCG, wrote a book called Our Awesome Universe Potential. And in one section, he mentions Hubble, and he writes, quote, "Hubble has recorded more than 500,000 pictures. Every month it produces enough to fill 70 complete sets of encyclopedias. These dazzling images inspire some penetrating questions. Where does it end? Where did it all come from? Is there any meaning behind it all? Why is it here? Why, for that matter, am I here? This telescope is the most impressive of an array of tools that are helping us to coax the cosmos into revealing its secrets and mysteries. And the more we study, the more we learn, the stronger the evidence becomes of an absolutely remarkable truth. There is an author of the cosmos, and he intended for us to be able to study the stars to help us come to know him." So those are some very powerful statements about Hubble and what it's shown to us. And right now, while the world is in these surreal and unsettling times, with much unknown and with more time for many of us to reflect on some of the big questions, maybe right now is as important a time as any for us to spend a little while looking at the images Hubble has taken and studying all the real estate that's out there waiting. If you go to the show notes for today's program, either at the Sun Also Rises Hub on thetrumpet.com or on soundcloud.com, just search for The Sun Also Rises. And in the notes at both locations, we've left a link there to some of the most spectacular images Hubble has taken. You can study the deep field images that Robert Williams and his team took, and so many others that can just literally take your breath away. Especially if you don't just scan these images, but really study them and try to imagine the scale of it all and the power that brought it all into being. Before we wrap up this episode that's been looking back on 30 years of the Hubble Space Telescope, I wanted to briefly look ahead to another window into the heavens that is going to be opened very soon. Hopefully we'll be able to do a full episode on this in the months ahead, but the James Webb Space Telescope is the scientific successor to Hubble. It'll also be placed in space above the distortion of Earth's atmosphere, but it won't stop there. The Webb telescope will actually travel almost 1 million miles from Earth, well past the moon, and all the way out to a place called L2. L2 is short for the second Lagrange point, and from this remote location, where gravity from the sun and the Earth balance out, the Webb telescope will go into orbit around the sun and in a fixed position relative to Earth. This is all designed to let this incredibly powerful telescope see as far as possible from an area where it's as shielded as possible from the sun's light. The James Webb telescope was originally scheduled to launch back in 2007, but like Hubble, it's faced all kinds of delays and cost overruns. That's partly because with this telescope going so far from Earth, we can't just send a crew of astronauts up to fix it if anything goes wrong the way we did with Hubble. There's no capability to service it once it's launched, so everything on this $10 billion piece of equipment has to be triple and quadruple checked before launch. And that launch is scheduled to finally happen on March 30th of 2021, so less than a year off now. And while Hubble was able to see what you could call toddler galaxies from about 12 billion years ago, Webb will be able to look back even further, over 13.5 billion years, and it'll be able to see infant galaxies, the first ones ever formed. Its mirror is almost 3 times the size of Hubble's, and its collecting area is more than 6 times that of Hubble. And it also sees in infrared. So the James Webb Space Telescope will be about 100 times more powerful than Hubble, and it's expected to rewrite our astronomy textbooks in so many ways that we can't yet even imagine. So keep your seatbelts on for that launch coming up in March. Well, that brings us to the end of The Sun Also Rises here on KPCG-FM. Remember to check out our show notes for some links to some of Hubble's most breathtaking images, and for links to one of the very powerful Key of David episodes that Mr. Gerald Fleury gave on the topic of Hubble and what its discoveries tell us about man's future. And we'll also have a link there to Our Awesome Universe Potential by Mr. Joel Hilliker. This is a deeply impacting book, and we send them out totally free. No shipping charges or anything else, so be sure to order your free copy of that. Well, we'd like to thank you for listening to The Sun Also Rises, and also thank NASA for making all of those Hubble images free for anyone to look at. And we'll leave you today with the words of Jason Silva. We have all kinds of limitations as human beings. I mean, we can't see the whole electromagnetic spectrum. We can't see the very small. We can't see the very far. So we compensate for these shortcomings with technological scaffoldings. The microscope allows us to extend our vision into the microsphere. The telescope allows us to extend our vision into the macrosphere. The Hubble Space Telescope extends our optic nerve into space, and it allows us to mainline space and time through our optic nerve.